Welcome, Beyond the Walls with Team World Vision. This is LDR, and this is our 20th episode, team. Thank you for getting beyond your walls with us every week. And as you move your feet this morning, this Saturday morning, our Hood to Coast runners across the country are leaning into their final legs of their 200-mile virtual relay. When a race cancels, we continue to go farther together. Whether we're in person or spread out across the country, we move our feet for kids and clean water. As of this recording, Hood to Coast has raised over $870,000. All the cowbells are ringing for you, my friends. Lean in, enjoy the ride, and cross that finish line with all you've got. Way to go. This week, you get to log a few miles with two incredible humans whom I also get to call friends and colleagues, Esther Knox and Michael Forsberg. Enjoy your run and enjoy the conversation.
Well, I'm so excited to be on this podcast and to get to talk to Michael Forsberg. My name is Esther. I just wanted to start by introducing a little bit about us. So, Berg, could you introduce yourself and tell a little bit about who you are and what you do at World Vision?
I'm so excited. I also just got this like really exciting wave of not nervousness, but just fun, like fun jitters. So my name is Michael Forsberg, but there are so many Michaels at World Vision in our team and so many Michaels in the world, hashtag 80s kids. So people call me by my last part of my last name, Berg, Forsberg. So I've got many names, but one of the things that I do is I help bring our experiences to life across our teams. And so in the very beginning of my time at World Vision, I was working with Team World Vision, helping that folks could experience running marathons, training for them, experiencing community in incredible ways. And so that was the start, and they've just let me continue to have fun and play and imagine and dream and help bring clean water, nutritious food, all sorts of good stuff to kids and communities around the world. That's what I get to do, and I love it.
My name is Esther Knox. I work on the experience team for Team World Vision. So I work where Berg used to work and get to dream up experiences for Team World Vision runners and for marathons and half marathons, which is really, really exciting. So Berg, I wanted to start by asking a little icebreaker. So I wanted to ask you about your marathons. How many marathons have you run with World Vision over the course of your time with Team World Vision?
So I started my first marathon with Team World Vision, and first marathon period was in 2011. So I'm coming up on my 10-year anniversary here pretty soon. And this is going to sound like a pretentious question, but I've kind of lost track of the official distance that I've run 26.2 miles because Team World Vision keeps inviting me to go farther together. So I keep going further and I keep running all these races, but I've run the marathon distance over, I don't know, 20 times. In my time at Team World Vision so far.
I can't believe that you've done so many marathons that you just lose track of it.
I don't know. Just one of the things about Team World Vision is that it keeps inviting you to do more and incredible things. And I personally get so wrapped up and caught up in all the things that I'm doing, I forget to track and mark down what happened afterwards. There's this like memory, like this blurry memory. And every once in a while, I would go back into my phone and look at old photos of different events and different races. And part of the reason why I lost track is because one of the races that Team World Vision invites us to do is called the Comrades Ultra Marathon. You might've heard of it, 56 miles or so up and down the hills of South Africa. And in order to train for that, you have to run 26.2 miles, full marathon distances, multiple times in training. And so I've done that race 3 times, which means that in training, I've maybe run that marathon distance, I don't know, 5 to 7 times per training season. So you just lose count and you just try to survive. You're just surviving at this point.
Wow, that is so incredible. So this is actually my first year running and training for a marathon. I'm training for the Pomoja Chicago Marathon in October. And so I was curious if you have any tips on training for a newbie.
Yes. Tip number one, don't compare yourself to anyone that has run multiple marathons. Don't compare yourself to people that have been doing this for a long time. Don't compare yourself to the pros. Compare yourself to your past self that's never done this before. I think that's my number one advice is recognizing how proud you are at the fact that you've signed up, number one, and then just remember why you signed up, number two. And then number three is that every single day is different. There's good days, there's bad days, there's days that you look forward to running, there's days that you dread running, but really taking it one day at a time, one step at a time is kind of the meta advice. But I would say the most practical advice that I found is making sure that you put on your running clothes and your running shoes and going outside, because for me, that's half the battle. Is if I don't want to run, it's easier to not run if I'm on my couch in my non-running clothes. But putting on your shoes, lacing up, going outside is a huge, huge first step.
That is such good advice, especially to me as I'm beginning. It's so easy to compare yourself to others, and it's so easy to think about all of the numbers and what you have to do. But one of the things that I have been told as well to think about is that forward is a pace. You don't have to really focus on how fast you're going or be really worked up about that, but you're moving forward and you're going to cross the finish line, because that's the start line for a lot of children.
Absolutely. That's so good. I think when we talk about the clean water needs in the world, the global water crisis, it could be really easy to kind of think about it at a cerebral level. But when you're out running and you're thirsty, it just reminds you so much more tangibly why we run, why we put ourselves through just this 6 month journey. And it's so powerful to remember and recall the purpose, because quite easily, I remember my first year, one word of warning that a previous marathoner said to all of us was, beware of the vanity that comes with marathon running. Beware of the vanity. In other words, she said, you're going to lose weight. You're going to feel better. People are going to compliment you on your life change. It can be really easy to start looking inward and seeing all of the internal self benefits that come with signing up for this race, but reminding ourselves of what the purpose is and why we're signing up in the first place. It's so true, Esther. You're right on.
And also remembering that in the moments when it is dreadful. I'm training with my husband to run the marathon, and I cannot tell you how many times I've said while we're running, why am I still doing this? Like, why are we running 13 miles? I am so over this training. And he has to keep reminding me, because children need clean water and you have water so easily accessible.
There's this just side note, luckily through World Vision, I've gotten to visit our water projects and the communities and the children in the field. And there's this one particular day we were visiting, and to your point, we were walking in a really long, hot space, actually carrying water. And there's this little girl, her name is Beverly. And we were taking turns carrying the water up this hill in this heat. And I was thinking about how hard it was to take these steps that we do in the US. And one of the World Vision staff members started to sing to us, how does it feel to be a Kenyan girl? And he was kind of not making fun of us, but he was kind of making light of the fact that this is what it feels like for these little girls. And he was doing it in a humorous way with levity. But I think of that little sing-song chime that he said to us, because when we're, to your point, making those thoughts around how hard it can be, it's easy to remember what is it like for a Kenyan girl or a girl from Bangladesh or a girl from Cambodia. That's why we do what we do.
I think it's so interesting exactly that song. Like, what does it feel like to be a Kenyan girl or someone from a different culture, which segues really smoothly into what I wanted to talk about with this podcast, is different backgrounds and how where you grow up really impacts how you live your life. So I would love for if you could start by introducing a little bit about your family background, your heritage, and how that has influenced you growing up.
Every year, actually the first year that I decided slash was called slash invited slash arm twisted into running a marathon with Team World Vision, I had a word of the year instead of a New Year's resolution, and that word was discipline, and I thought the marathon would help me with that. And so every year since then, I have been focused on word of the year. And last year, my word was heritage, that word that you just used. And it's a word for me because my mom is from the Philippines and my dad was born in the US of European descent. And so I had this mixed background, this mixed identity with two sides of the family that look very different from one another, that they speak very different than one another, their worldviews are different than one another. And so as an individual, I've been trying to figure out what does that mean for a person who has these two cultures living inside one body and one experience, and how do all those things shape up? And as we move forward in life, what do we keep from our families and what do we leave behind? And so I think the question that you asked is a personal one. I'm sitting in my room right now and have a map of the Philippines on the wall across from me, but I couldn't name most of the islands within the chain. So I think there's been this self-exploration, and I think one of the big ways that it's impacted my journey with World Vision is that it can be very easy to think of other countries experiencing poverty or a different level of accessibility. But growing up hearing stories from my mom's side of the family, that it doesn't feel as distant, it feels more real. And so when we sponsored children from the Philippines, my mom would tell me stories about what things were like for her as a little girl in the islands. And then for my dad in America, they also grew up in a less than ideal economic state. And so the things that we run for, the things we fundraise for, have become more personal to me. And it's become a little bit more confusing because who are we from our backgrounds and how do you merge different cultures into a new space?
The idea of who are we is really interesting to me as well. For all of you listening on the podcast who can't see us, Berg and I look very similar. My family background is almost the same as him. My dad is also white of European descent and my mom is Chinese. And so it's interesting hearing your story, Berg, of having that merge of two different backgrounds and being able to understand the world through two different lenses. It's so good to have that experience because you see the world through different lenses that people who have the same parental background don't necessarily get. So it really is a privilege to get to have that knowledge. Like your mom in the Philippines, my mom in Hong Kong, it's so vastly different than Western life. And you see so much poverty and you see dissolution in countries and cultures that you can't really explain it to somebody who lives in Western culture, but when you get to see it and on vision trips, when you get to see someone from Kenya or Bangladesh or Guatemala who lives a different life, it makes you realize that we're all so different, but at the same time, we have this humanity in us. Do you feel like there was ever a moment growing up that you realized that like, oh, my parents are different. Like they're not just the same, or like I'm different from other people.
I think there's a couple different moments that I can clearly remember. A lot of my friends growing up in my hometown of Elgin, Illinois were mixed too. And so it was kind of normal for mixed kids to be running the streets of Elgin. But I remember on those standardized tests when you have to fill in the forms and they ask you to like check your gender, check your age, and then check your racial identity. And they always made you check one box. And I always felt very confused because I knew that I had at least two boxes to check and I didn't know which one to check. And so I think that was probably my first recognition of how come this form on this standardized test doesn't match who I am. I think that was probably the first curiosity. And I think secondly, there were moments where I didn't realize it because my mom has darker tan skin and almost black hair, and my dad is blue-eyed, blonde hair. And so sometimes people would make comments when I was walking with my dad at how different I looked than him. And it was confusing to me because I didn't ever think about the similarities or differences of how you look like one parent more than the other. And I'd take after my mom and my sort of genetic outward exterior, And I think that was maybe kind of confused too, of like, why don't I look like my dad as much? And why do people notice that? And I didn't notice that. So there's moments like that as a kid, you start to question and then you start to ponder and then it leads you into more questioning. And
right. And when you're a kid and you haven't quite had that awareness yet, you do think that your parents are the same until you take a step back. And I think as you get older, there's more stereotypes that are taught inherently just through social interactions that really make you realize. I actually had the exact same experience of like checking off boxes. And for me, I would just check off white because I wanted to be white. There's this like idea of a superior race in a way. And I always admired my dad, and I love my mom, but I just thought, I'm supposed to be white. I want to be white so badly. So I'm just going to check off white. And it hasn't been until recently where I've been more welcoming and accepting of my culture and wanting to carry that out through the rest of my life. But it's weird how like these experiences as a child can really influence how you live out your life.
Totally. I mean, even our names, like your name is Esther, my name is Michael. That doesn't seem exclusively Chinese or exclusively Filipino. Those are like very common names, biblical names. And knowing that there's like these ways that the world interprets us, if my name were like some of my cousins that is not as European based, that would change sort of how people treat me and treat you. And I think it's a curious thing when we have a white parents and you can be white passing, but also in the same way people look at you and they don't quite know if you're white. And so sometimes there's this double-edged sword where some groups will want you to be more white than you are and some groups will make you browner than you are, and it's just kind of confusing to figure out where to fit in and what to be. Even if you check the white box and you want to identify as white, people still won't treat you as such because they'll see you as something different.
Do you think that idea of the way that people see us as other has really influenced the way you interact with them?
That's a good question. I think there's at least two categories of thought that I have initially. One is being more aware. There's been some spots in parts of America where I've been told to like park on the other side where everyone else parked, and they told me white power. And so like moments like that, or people that will, I'm often miscategorized too. And so people often speak Spanish to me when they're frustrated that I'm not following their directions. And so there's a awareness that at any given point people can type or mistype me and treat me accordingly, which is one of the ways to go about the world of always trying to think of how am I being assessed. And because folks like us are a little bit more mysterious, there's a little bit more ambiguity, so it's not as clear cut of the response that we'll get from people. So there's the awareness piece. But then the other piece is, it's exciting to, like you mentioned earlier, live in both worlds, because there's also been scenarios where people of color are in a scenario and they see me as a extension of the group. I remember one of my first jobs outside of college in the corporate space, it was mostly white, and there was a handful of folks who were minority status or people of color, and they like found out my heritage and they kind of brought me into their pseudo group of what it's like to be in corporate America. There was folks who were black, folks who were Latino, folks who were, yeah, that was it. That was the categories. Oh, there was like a couple Asian folks too, but they saw me for, I don't know, something different. And it's also bizarre to be seen in multiple facets and fashions when you know exactly what you are, but you're constantly seeing people trying to assess and figure out who you are, which can make you want to either be very bold and outright and say, here's what I am, stop trying to guess what I am, or just hide it and let them wonder and ask silly questions, not for the sake of them being silly, but for the sake that sometimes there's an overemphasis and over premium on trying to guess people's ethnic background so you can treat them as such. I think one of the ways, perhaps having kind of this dual lens, there was a time in which, this is a different work experience, but this girl came up to me and she was Mexican. And she walked up to me with this kind of puzzled look and she said, are you one of us? Are you one of them? In other words, I knew what she was asking, but I said, what do you mean by that? She's like, are you Mexican or are you white? And I think that has really rang true to me because the answer is both, not Mexican, but not white. There's this level of us and them thinking that I think can be really, really hurtful when we think about global poverty, where here's us and then there's them. And I don't have as much of an us-them mentality because I feel like there's more of a we. And I love the ways that World Vision, we've been talking about Matthew 25 and that line where it says, brothers and sisters of mine, the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, not just least of these. And so that has kind of informed my perception because I don't see it as we Americans and they other people in the developing world that don't have as much. I think of it as we, the global united world that happen to have different levels of access and wealth. And when you think about it as a we mentality, there's a greater likelihood to hopefully share and care for your brother and your sister. Same thing with, I guess, growing up being mixed, I had also a lot of friends with other backgrounds that were different than my own. And that brought me into more relationships with more people from backgrounds that are akin to the communities that we serve. One of my best friends in the world has this African background. And so I don't see Africans as this distant people group. I see it as people like my best friends. And so when you translate and you change distant people groups and think of them as our broader global family, it makes it, at least for me, so much easier to not think about an us-them solving poverty, but we're all experiencing poverty if some of us are experiencing poverty.
One experience that I'm thinking of for myself is in university, I studied abroad in Ghana, and I was there for 3 months. And this was not my first time being abroad. I lived as a missionary kid in China for many years, but this was my first time being in a culture that was very, very different than me. But I remember being welcomed in. I worked at a radio station while I was there, and all of the people who I worked with called me their sister. And they called everybody brother and sister, no matter who they were. If they were white, if they were Asian like me, or if they were African, they welcomed you into their family. And I think that that's something so beautiful about the human race, is that we are all part of God's family. And no matter where we come from, we belong together. Mm-hmm. We're here on this earth and we all share human experiences that maybe look slightly different than each other. You may have a Hispanic or Mexican experience that's different from an American experience, that's different from Ghanaian, that's different from Chinese. It's different, but at the end of the day, we all have the same blood, and our purpose on earth is to love each other and to build each other up and to support each other. And like you said, if one is suffering, then we're all suffering. And I think that's so true when you look at the global landscape and just how much hurt there is and how much there is that God is going to redeem. And that's just what we're here to live for, right? To build each other into future glory.
Amen. Yeah. All nations, all tongues, future glory in Revelation, 20:17? Back half. Can't wait.
Thank you.
I think about the kingdom is here and now, like that's one part of the kingdom that we see prophesied in Revelation, this every tribe unified. But if the kingdom is here now, I did go to Bible college and did take some theology degrees. I'm not a theologian, but my theological perspective is that if the kingdom is here now and we want to see the kingdom on earth as it is in heaven, then on earth we have to have unity. We have to have racial reconciliation. We have to have all nations, tribes, and tongues united, just like we see written. And so I would love to keep learning about how we can express racial justice in a biblical sense, because we need the church to step up in a big way. And I'm excited to see more people, more congregations, more communities, more churches, more pastors to be living outward and forward into this journey of reconciliation, because my greatest fear is that this is a hot topic now and then it'll kind of get pushed back to the fringe again, and then will continue to regress and unity would not be restored.
Another question I had is, your wife is not mixed either, is she?
Mm-mm.
Can you talk a little bit about your relationship? You've seen your parents' relationship of two different cultures uniting, and now you have a interracial marriage as well. What does that look like for you?
That's a great question. When I was younger, any girl that I would date on my mom's side, my aunts would always, the first question they would ask is, oh, Michael, you have a girlfriend, is she Filipina? They would always want to know if she was Filipino. And I was always so curious, like, why does that matter? You know, as a teenage kid or whatever, I would kind of be annoyed by it. But later on now, I can see it's because my sister, who's also half Filipino, half white, her husband is all white, and they have a beautiful baby named Walter. He's like he's almost 3 years old now, and so he's not quite a baby, but he's always going to be a baby to us. And to see what it looks like to pass on heritage and culture and tradition once you kind of are further removed from the sort of family unit, and all the other mixed babies that are being born that have like less Filipino blood, it makes a little bit more sense, the curiosity of whether or not I was dating a Filipino girl. And so I think being married to Jill, it made me realize that there were so many things in my culture that I took for granted, or that it was just kind of a natural state. And then in our new home, in our new household, in our new space, there was this kind of reckoning of like all the default things that was bicultural in my household now have to be more intentional. Otherwise, those customs, traditions, part of our history could evaporate just out of neglect. And so I think that's probably the biggest thing, is why heritage has become more important to me recently, is this recognition of, as we continue to move forward in life, what do we take with us from our families and how do we keep building upon it? Because just assuming that your aunts and your uncles and your cousins and all these rich cultural traditions that you grew up with won't always be there if you don't do some level of intentional curation of history and culture.
Absolutely.
What about you?
Absolutely. I think my answer is very similar, if not exactly the same as yours. I'm also married to a white man, and it's hard because, like you're saying, you want to hold on to as much of your heritage as you can, but it's so easily lost. And I think one of the things that we talk about for our family is we want to hold on to as much of Asian background as we can, his Dutch background as we can, because when our children, when we have children, if we have children, they won't understand it in the same way that we do. And in culture and heritage and tradition changes as generations go on. And that's just part of life, right? That's the life cycle. Things are never exactly as they were, as although you want to hold on to what you have as much as you can, but it's never the same. And it just turns into a new dynasty. And kind of the cool thing as well is that you and I are mixed, and that in itself is a whole different culture. Mm-hmm. And that in itself can carry on for generations. And I think that's what I love about meeting so many different types of mixed people, because even if you meet somebody who's Chinese and Black, they have similar experiences too. And so you get to have this really cool camaraderie with people who have so many different experiences, but all the same.
Totally. I mean, a couple years ago, within the church and ministry partners team, we were doing, and it still happens today, kind of times to share out about conversations of race and experience. And I got to share about being a mixed kid, and I was doing some research, and it is interesting to see the data on how there are more children being born today that are mixed than ever before. More children who are not white being born today. I think the kindergarten class of today is majority non-white. And so the culture is certainly changing in America. It's changing. Can feel scary for some folks that things are changing, but change is good and change isn't scary if you don't let it be. And there's something neat to see about the people that came before us, because what was it, 50 some years ago, interracial marriage was illegal in the US. And so now there's more mixed babies being born because it's legal. And I just hope that as we keep seeing more interracial marriages and relationships and children being born, that there could be more of a understanding of how confusing it can be as a kid to not know your place in the world and how to interact. And so I think there's something special about seeing even more mixed people on TV, in the media, in leadership, just to show that you're not like the only weirdo on the playground anymore.
Yeah. That's so true. And change is good. Like, I'm excited to see in 50 years what the world looks like and how people interact with each other. Like, we're in this really hot time of talking about race more openly than we ever have before. So how is that going to change really the dynamic of society over the course of the years? And I'm really excited for the time when future generations get to live together in harmony.
Lord, we pray your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Open our eyes to see the world as you see it. Break our hearts with what breaks yours, and empty us of all but love. If you enjoyed the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share. See you next week.